So our passage is Proverbs chapter 13, verses 12 to 25. And at the beginning of this passage, and in the middle of this passage, and at the end of this passage, there surfaces a particular concept. And I can assure you that this is a relevant concept. This passage may have been written in a different age from ours, and it may have been written in a different culture from ours, and it may have been written in a different language from ours, but this concept is nonetheless absolutely contemporary. You only have to listen to pop songs presently in the charts. You only have to watch films presently in the cinemas to appreciate that this is a relevant concept. What am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about true satisfaction. The deepest longings and desires of your heart being fulfilled. That's the concept that surfaces three times explicitly in our passage. So mentioned there in verse 12 at the start, a desire fulfilled. And then in the middle, verse 19, we have the same language, desire fulfilled. And then slightly different language in the last verse, verse 25, but when it talks there about the satisfaction of the appetite, it has a broader reference than merely to eating, to food in the stomach. It's talking about the satisfaction of our appetites more generally. And I guess the most important of those three references is the first one. Because that first one then, in verse 12, it tells us what fulfilled desire actually looks like. When satisfaction is there, when the deepest longings of the human heart are being fulfilled, what does that look like? Well, it's not finding that romantic relationship with Mr. Right or Mrs. Right. It's not accumulating that multi-million pound personal fortune. It's not securing that place in the annals of history through some notable achievement, becoming famous. That's not what true satisfaction looks like. What does true satisfaction look like? It looks like a tree of life. That's what verse 12 says. And of course, you all know that's borrowed language. That's not original to Solomon. He's borrowing that from the very earliest sections of the Hebrew scriptures, from the early chapters of Genesis and the Garden of Eden, where, of course, the tree of life was situated. And where it symbolized then that fullness of life which Adam and Eve had. We talked last week a little bit about this in connection with Acts chapter 5. And how then there is, of course, biological life. The heart beating, the brain active, the lungs functioning. There is biological life. But the Bible also uses this term life in a richer and deeper sense. We were built, the Bible indicates, to know and to enjoy our Creator God. And truly being alive, therefore, truly conforming to the very purpose of our existence, is doing that, is knowing and enjoying God. And so verse 12 is saying then that when a person has that, when a person has life, when a person has that relationship with God for which he or she was made, then that person has true satisfaction, has the deepest longings of the heart fulfilled. And our passage, of course, implies that this is possible. This is not some unattainable ideal merely. No, this is possible. Having the desires of your heart fulfilled in this way is possible. And I just want us to notice several things then arising from that. First of all, the alternative. The alternative. What's the alternative to what I've just described? Well, the alternative to being truly alive and experiencing true satisfaction is, of course, being dead and experiencing dissatisfaction. And again, there is, of course, such a thing as biological, clinical death. The heart's no longer beating, the brain no longer active, the lungs no longer functioning. But the Bible also talks about death in a deeper sense than that. Again, we were built to know and to enjoy God. And being dead then, missing the purpose of our existence, is failing to do that. Failing to know and enjoy God. Failing to be in a close and intimate relationship with him. And you'll notice then that in verse 14, we have this very powerful image of death as a kind of hunter laying traps, or snares is the word that we have here, for its prey. And that raises the question then, what are these snares? What are these traps? Well, it's probably a reference to all those God substitutes, if you like, to which human beings look for fulfillment instead of God. The kind of things I mentioned a moment ago, the romantic relationship, the personal fortune, the place in the history books, whatever it might be. In other words, then, verse 14 is saying that those who are missing the very purpose of existence, those who are failing to know and enjoy God, they aren't actually just dead. But more than that, they are being led on a merry dance, you might almost say, constantly thinking they have found what they're looking for, constantly thinking they have found satisfaction, when actually they are deceived and are dying more and more with each new God substitute they fall for. Verse 12 then describes the psychological impact of all this. So these people then, and this is all of us in our natural state, this is the default human position since Eden. These people are constantly full of hope. I found the thing now that is going to satisfy me. I found the thing that's really going to fulfill my deepest desires. And after a while, they realize that it's not doing that. And so the hope has to be deferred until the next thing. And then they think they've found what they're looking for. But again, proves not to be the case. The hope has to be deferred again and again and again. And over time, Solomon says, this process just makes the heart sick. It makes a person more and more inwardly frustrated and agitated and restless, constantly looking for satisfaction, thinking they found it, realizing they haven't, having to defer their hope on this permanent quest, but never coming to the end of it. And perhaps that's where you are this evening. May not be apparent to others looking at you from the outside. You may seem sorted. May seem like everything's okay with you. But you know that deep down, there is that sickness of the heart. There is that frustration, that restlessness. You know that you haven't found what you are looking for. You know that the deepest longings of your heart are still being unfulfilled tonight. And that's the alternative then to what Solomon sets out as possible. Solomon sets out as possible desire being fulfilled. But it may be that tonight, that's not the situation you're in. You're in this opposite situation. Desire unfulfilled. This restless, interminable quest for something that seems thoroughly elusive to you. Well, if that's the case, you need to listen carefully as we move on to our second heading. We've seen the alternative. Secondly, the secret. The secret. So what is the secret then? How do we get to this point? We've said that our natural default position as human beings since Eden is to be in this verse 12, first half of the verse situation, is to be in this restless quest. Well, how do we reach this point where we do know and enjoy our Creator God and are truly alive, therefore, and our desires are being fulfilled? How do we get there? Well, clearly, in this passage then, it has to do with responding properly to something verbal, something that's variously described in verses 13 and 14 as the word, the commandment, and the teaching. And so responding properly then is, on the one hand, negatively, it's not despising this teaching, this commandment, this word. More positively, it's revering it, the second half of verse 13. And presumably then, this thing that is to be properly responded to, presumably it's God's revelation. It's that which God has spoken. That's what's being referred to in these descriptions, the word, the commandment, the teaching. God's revelation. But the problem then, of course, is this, that God's revelation is pretty big. I mean, God has spoken fairly extensively. And yet Solomon speaks here of the word, the commandments, the teaching. That sounds so simple and clear cut, and yet God has spoken all these pages that we have in front of us in our Bibles this evening. And we need to know then, what in a nutshell is it to respond properly to what God has spoken? What, when stripped down to the irreducible core, what is it to respond properly to that which God has spoken? Well, we this evening, of course, aren't the first people to have asked that question. There was an occasion in Jesus' life when he was teaching a crowd of people, and the question was put to him by some in that crowd. This question, it's in John chapter 6, verse 28. What must we do to be doing the works of God? It's a similar question, isn't it, to what we're asking this evening? Because again, the works of God, what God requires of us, from one perspective, that's massive. There's loads of stuff involved. But they're saying, Jesus, boil it down for us. Strip it down to the core thing. What does it mean, in a nutshell, to be doing the works of God? And this is Jesus' answer. It's a crucial answer. John 6, verse 29, Jesus answered them, "This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent." That you believe in him whom he has sent. He's referring, of course, to himself. Jesus is the one whom God has sent. In other words, then, and of course, Proverbs and John's Gospel, though separated in our Bibles, different genres, different in so many ways, they are part of this one book in which each section is organically connected to every other section. And so it's proper to relate Proverbs 13 to John 6. Jesus is saying that properly responding to what God has spoken is ultimately this. It's believing in him. It's trusting in Jesus Christ. And when we do that then, when we trust in Jesus Christ, Solomon says in verse 14 that it turns you away from the snares of death. It turns you away from all those inauthentic substitutes that all your life until that moment you were pursuing so relentlessly, that disappointed you in every single case without exception. Finally, you trust in Jesus Christ and it turns you away from all the fakes, all the duds, all the inauthentic substitutes, so that you do truly know and enjoy God. And notice actually that our passage indicates there's kind of an intermediate stage that you pass through when this happens, between responding to the commandment, the word, the teaching, which we've said is trusting in Jesus, between that and being ushered into this relationship with God, knowing him and enjoying him. There's an intermediate stage. It's described in verse 15, good sense wins favor. And again, in the context of good sense, it's not talking vaguely about just being kind of sensible. It's talking about responding properly to God's revelation. And it's saying then that doing that, and we've said doing that means trusting in Jesus, ultimately, doing that wins favor. Wins favor with whom? Well, with God himself, of course. This is the germ, isn't it, of the doctrine that Paul will set out. So clearly and so eloquently in his letters, the doctrine of justification by faith, that when you trust in Jesus Christ, God, who prior to that moment related to you as a condemning judge, in that moment becomes an approving judge. He pronounces you righteous. He declares you to be in the right. He acquits you. The judge of all the earth is happy with you. And that's what verse 15 ultimately means. That when you respond then to God's word, which means trusting in Jesus Christ, you in that moment win favor, win acceptance with God himself. You're reconciled to him. You're pronounced in the right by him. And then you are ushered into this intimate and beautiful relationship with him. And so the secret then isn't complicated. It's dead simple. And if you are in that position I described a moment ago, restless, pursuing things that aren't providing what you're looking for, because they're not God, then the secret for you tonight is simple. Cry out to Jesus Christ, Lord Jesus, make me right with God. Through your work here on earth 2,000 years ago, your cross, your resurrection, reconcile me to God. Give me favor, acceptance with God, and then usher me into this relationship with him, where I know him and enjoy him and have the deepest desires of my heart fulfilled in him. Go to Jesus tonight. That's the secret. Go to Jesus, and he will bring you into this state that we're talking about. The alternative, the secret. Thirdly this evening, the effects. The effects. Because when then you have done that, And when you have responded properly and you have trusted in Jesus and you've become truly alive and the desires of your heart are being fulfilled, it changes your whole existence. You are different from that moment. And our passage just gives a few examples. Certainly it's not exhaustive, but it just gives a few little examples of how you are different after you've come to find satisfaction and fulfillment in God through faith in Jesus Christ. For one thing, you're different professionally, our passage says. You're different professionally. Verse 17 seems a little random, doesn't it? Stuck in the middle there. But this is, I think, how it relates. In that verse, Solomon singles out kind of one profession, one occupation. It's not an obvious one that you or I would single out if we were trying to just think off the top of our heads of an occupation being a messenger or an envoy. But of course, in Solomon's culture, it was a pretty important position. There was no email back then. There wasn't much in the way of royal mail either. This was a pretty crucial role. And the point then is this. Suppose for the sake of argument, you're seeking fulfillment in wealth. That's the thing where you're looking for satisfaction. In that case, you are going to do your job, your work, your daily employment with one overriding motive. And that overriding motive is going to be to make as much money as possible. And at some point, the most effective way of doing that is going to be by compromising. By compromising ethically, by cutting corners. And that then is what has been envisaged in this verse, I think. Here we have a messenger who has been entrusted, in this case, with some good news, actually. Some good news to deliver. But, you see, he can not deliver it. But then go and tell his boss, oh yes, I've delivered that message that you gave me to deliver. And by doing that, he can get his next message much more quickly and can do more jobs and can make more money. By cutting that corner. By saying he's delivered the message when he hasn't, he can make more money for himself. And so he becomes in that way then, because he's seeking fulfillment in wealth, it's led him down this route whereby he's become, Solomon says, a wicked messenger who will fall into trouble inevitably at some point, sooner or later. But you see, if on the other hand, you found fulfillment in God, then you don't need to go down that route. Finding fulfillment in God liberates you to do your job properly. To do your job not driven by some ulterior motive, but to do your job conscientiously and rigorously, and actually to enjoy the contentment that's inherently contained within that. Because as we said, it's good news that will bring healing to the community or the person where you're taking it in this particular instance. It will liberate you to participate to the full in your job in a right way, because your fulfillment comes from elsewhere. It comes from God. You're different professionally, but then for another thing, you're different socially. You're different socially. Look at verse 20. Whoever walks with the wise becomes wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Again then, just for the sake of argument, imagine that you're looking for fulfillment in wealth. And if that's the case, that is going to affect your social choices. That's already become pretty clear, hasn't it, in Proverbs. You think of, I think it's perhaps most clear back in chapter 1, which we looked at now several months ago, verses 10 to 14. This is the father then warning his son. He says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without reason, like Sheol, let us swallow them alive and whole, like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all precious goods, we shall fill our houses with plunder. Throw in your lot among us, we will all have one purse.'" If you are looking for fulfillment in wealth, and you've got people saying that to you, you're going to say, "Yeah, well, I'll go along with these people. I will throw in my lot with them. We will have one purse. These will be my mates. I'll hang out with these people because that's going to be a way of me filling my house with plunder." In other words, if you're looking for fulfillment in the wrong place, that could well lead to you falling in with the wrong crowd, Proverbs is saying. Whereas if, on the other hand, you found fulfillment in God himself, you don't need that. It liberates you to choose companions and friends who will be good for you and will have a good influence on you, those who are wise and will help you to become wiser. You're different socially. So you're different professionally, socially, but then thirdly, you're different domestically. Look at verses 22 to 24, and we have an interesting sequence outlined here. So in verse 22, Solomon says, "A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children." And this then is probably along similar lines to what we were looking at last week in the first half of the chapter, and indeed in previous passages in Proverbs, that the good man, the righteous man, the wise man, the godly man is going to be diligent, and being diligent will often cause him to become relatively well off financially and economically, not necessarily, but there's that general pattern, that general trend, and he'll be in a position then to leave something for his children and even for his grandchildren. And that's great then, that's positive, that's good. But then you see in verse 23, it's as if Solomon is suddenly struck by a thought, but hang on a minute, we're living in a fallen world here where there's much injustice, there are bad men, there are exploiters, there are cheaters. And that means then that even if you are being conscientious and diligent, then it doesn't guarantee that you will have something to leave to your children at the end of the day. Because all it takes is someone to come along and do you out of it. And you won't have anything to leave. That's his next thought. But then it's as if in verse 24, he has another thought still. And his next thought is, well, actually, that's not a tragedy. It is, of course, if you're looking for your fulfillment in wealth. If you're looking for your fulfillment in wealth, then the apex of that is having lots to leave to your children at the end of your life. And if you haven't got anything to leave to your children at the end of your life, you failed, and your life has been an utter and unmitigated disaster. If you're looking for fulfillment in wealth, that's the case. But if you've found fulfillment in God, then that liberates you to prioritize, verse 24 is saying, another kind of investment in your children. Yes, it's great to be able to leave them some money, of course. But it liberates you to prioritize, to value even more highly another kind of investment, shaping their characters for the future. Producing through your discipline, through your teaching, through your careful rearing, producing men and women for the future who will be solid and faithful and righteous. It liberates you to prioritize that instead of having plenty of silver and gold to leave them. And so I'm saying then that if you trust in Jesus Christ and you become alive in the biblical sense, fulfilling your desires on the one you were built to fulfill your desires upon, then that will change you in all sorts of far-reaching ways. And these are just some of them, professionally, socially, and domestically. The alternative, the secret, the effects. But then fourthly and finally, the problem. The problem. Why then doesn't everybody just do this? I mean, it's so simple, surely. You go from one thing to the other, these fakes, these duds, these God substitutes, don't find any fulfillment. Here, the Bible is just so clear. Of course you won't. You weren't made for those. You were made by God, for God, to be close to God. Of course that's where you're going to find fulfillment. Why doesn't everybody do it? Why haven't you perhaps done that tonight? Even though perhaps you've been to church many times before, you've heard all this stuff over and over again. How come you haven't done it? How come you're still in the rat race, still in the relentless quest, still banging your head on brick wall after brick wall? How come? Well, verse 19 tells us very soberingly why. A desire fulfilled is sweet to the soul, but to turn away from evil, and here it's not talking about evil as in to turn away from being a robber or a paedophile or a terrorist. The evil in view here is the evil of chasing all these wrong substitutes for God, pursuing fulfillment in the wrong places. To turn away from evil, so to turn from those to the true God through faith in Jesus Christ, is an abomination to fools. It's not just kind of less attractive than looking for fulfillment in wealth or sex or whatever it might be. It's actually abominable to people. I've talked already about our default position. Our default position is as serious as this. This is our default position, naturally, the way we're born, that looking for fulfillment in God is abominable to us. It's loathsome to us. It's detestable to us. We would rather look for it anywhere than look for it in God. That's what verse 19 is saying. It just seems so ridiculous to us. It just seems so ludicrous, such a non-starter, so crazy. Why would I trust in Jesus Christ? Why would I look to find fulfillment that route? That's our natural default position. And I know, therefore, that this evening I'm not going to be able to persuade you to trust in Jesus Christ and fulfill your heart's desires in the God who made you. And you might think, well, why did you bother starting on this sermon in the first place then? Well, the reason is that although I know I can't persuade you, I know there's someone who can. The same person who has persuaded me, the same person who has persuaded many, most in this room this evening. And that person is Jesus himself. He's the only one who can persuade you to turn to him. He does that not through suddenly appearing to you in a dream or something. He does it through sermons. He does it through preaching. And I trust that even tonight, Jesus, who alone can smash through that prejudice that is really thick and deep set in you tonight, I trust that he may smash through that prejudice. And that what at this moment perhaps seems abominable to you, becoming a Christian believer, will suddenly become the most obvious and the most beautiful thing to you. May it be so. Amen. Our closing hymn is number 560. The Saviour calls, let every ear.